been another record-breaking year for Milwaukee, but not in a good way. According to the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, there have been 193 homicides in the city in 2021. The previous record was 190 set last year, and there's still 2.5 weeks left to go. 90% of those deaths involved guns. It's a similar story in other cities around the country. ABC News recently reported that a dozen cities, including St. Paul, Minnesota, have also reached all-time highs for homicides. And like Milwaukee, some of the broke records that were just set last year. Experts say there's no one clear answer for the jump in homicides, but they've got some suspicions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this uptick in homicides over the last couple of years? Are you worried about violent crime in your own community? What do you think would need to happen to bring those numbers down? Do you work in a field where you see these firsthand as a police officer or in a hospital? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Janice Awama is an assistant professor in the Department of Justice, Law, and Criminology at American University. Her research interests include bias and hate crimes, communities and crime, gun legislation and violence, and policing. Janice, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, after a violent 2020, I think there was a lot of hope that it would be a one-year blip. Unfortunately, 2021 doesn't seem to be bearing that out. Were you surprised to see those numbers stay high this year?
I was surprised that the numbers remain that high, particularly with the expectations that as we reopen during the pandemic, that would be a lot more opportunities for violence interrupting programs like going back to school, a little bit more of a normal routine. So it is unexpected.
Where are we seeing this? We see the headlines, of course, about big cities. I've seen some smaller stories that say, you know, smaller sized cities, other communities are seeing upticks in homicide. What do we know about that so far?
So far, we won't know anything until the following year, but it looks like based on some of the preliminary data we have for 2021, that some of the largest cities are experiencing some spikes, significant spikes, nearly twice as many homicides, twice as many aggravated assault cases. Some of the smaller cities are also seeing some of that, not quite to the extent of some of the larger metropolitan areas, but it looks like across the area in rural, suburban, and urban areas that there is a spike. The extent of that definitely varies across different areas.
Let's get into the why now. And I think there are a lot of easy answers that maybe any one of them isn't always borne out. But what do you look toward, Janice, to explain these increases?
Sure, you can view the increases. It's very difficult to say, and we probably won't know for a couple of years, but there's two different thoughts that have come up. One is associated to the pandemic following COVID-19, of course, and the second is changes in policing. The first, obviously, the pandemic has led to an increase in unemployment. A lot of individuals at home trying to take care of sick relatives, and of course, some of those stay-at-home restrictions. The lifestyles that we now carry have dramatically changed since prior to COVID, prior to March of 2020, that possibly could have an impact on some of human behaviors. Also, some of the institutions that we generally depend on to help interrupt some of the violence that takes place, for example, education. We know that for a fact that with the closing of so many different schools across the United States, in light of the spikes in COVID-19, have led to a lot of kids at home, a lot of kids on the streets that don't have homes to go to, the lack of after-school programs that we also see as an opportunity to divert some of that violence, to provide assistance to some of those at-risk students that could potentially be violent prone or have also been closed as a result of COVID-19. Both government and non-government agencies that are generally there to divert some of that violence were no longer available during the pandemic. On the second hand, we also had changes in policing, specifically changes in policing as a result of social distancing, trying to reduce the number of citizens to police contacts because of a fear of COVID-19. The number of protests we felt since last summer associated to or concerned with the lack of trust and a lack of legitimacy with policing have also affected policing. A number of protests, for the most part, have removed some of those police officers from the smaller communities into those areas that we knew there were going to be police protests. Of course, the lack of trust and legitimacy by citizens meant that citizens were now going to take justice into their own hands and or also not report crimes because they no longer trust the police. They don't view them as a legitimate source to provide them with assistance. And so the likelihood is these two particular areas that do overlap have influenced some of the crime that we are seeing from last year and the crime that we are seeing even this year up until December of 2021. And the likelihood is that the spike in violent crime will be found in the national FBI data once it comes out by the end of the following year.
Talking to Janice Owama, assistant professor in the Department of Justice, Law and Criminology at American University, looking at increases, substantial increases over the last couple of years in the number of homicides, especially gun homicides, especially in big cities around the country. Milwaukee sadly just set a new record, breaking last year's record. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the topic, your questions for our guest, solutions you might like to see. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to tackle that last point you just brought up, Janice, about lack of trust between communities and police, maybe leading to people not reporting that smaller crime, and then that festers and leads perhaps to a homicide. How does a community start to rebuild that trust? How does a law enforcement agency start to rebuild that trust?
Absolutely. I think communities can start engaging in some discussions with police agencies, whether through an organization, whether through separate opportunities or events that happen to take place in their own community, and start really thinking about not going back to what is already in the books for policing, but thinking about innovative ways of trying to change policing. Obviously, one of the concerns we've had is the lack of reports, the underreporting of certain crimes. For example, there was also a spike in hate crimes. The underreporting of hate crimes meant that police officers who depend on citizens to engage in these types of issues and try to resolve these types of issues are no longer aware of any type of incident taking place. Police agencies, on the other hand, can think of their policing practices. Policing practices that generally carry a view of being discriminatory in nature, for example, stop and frisk practices, require almost a review to try to better understand whether or not they are actually leading to discrimination, they are actually leading to racial profiling in their own communities. Some of these conversations, while they are taking place in some cities, are not taking place in various different locations. They're not taking place and allowing citizens an opportunity to voice their concerns. There is also missing data and information on how policing has changed, whether it can change, and how we might go about doing that. And I will say now is a good opportunity, particularly as you see new leadership in so many police agencies, a new police chief coming up in so many different cities, to start engaging in those types of conversations and creating a new platform for citizens to engage with those police agencies.
I want to throw a couple other suggestions I've seen out there that people have linked to the rise in homicides. That police agencies are facing the same problem that many other employers are. They can't get enough people onto the job. Some of that might be driven by protests. Some of it might be driven by people retiring earlier because of COVID or wanting less risky types of work. Do you see this as a personnel problem in part?
Absolutely. Almost every major agency we've spoken to is extremely understaffed. They're understaffed and they're overworked. There's been a lot of police officers who've since retired, a lot of police officers who've had to take medical leave, either because of their own families, their loved ones having to take care of them during the pandemic, and they're tired. And that is something that police leadership really needs to account for. They need to think of better strategies to help their police employees in order to address some of their concerns they have, particularly as so many police officers had to take leave because of their kids, because of their significant others. And of course, there's also concern with how do we start recruiting the right police? How do we start making sure that police officers that we're trying to bring into the force are doing the right thing? And how do we recruit from a more wider, diverse group of police officers? That is something that you have to do intentionally rather than waiting and sitting back and depending on sort of previous practices that existed in policing.
Another explanation people have offered is a boom in gun sales last year, and 538.com did an analysis showing the time to crime, when a gun is bought to when it shows up in a crime, jumping a lot last year. Is the availability, apparently wider availability of guns, part of the story here?
Absolutely. I think both the increase in gun sales and the increase in reported guns found by police agencies while seizing guns at crime scenes has been a significant issue and has led to, in large part, a lot of the violent crime we are seeing, particularly when those cases, when we talk about homicides, the spike in homicides, somewhere between 80 and 90% of those homicides are associated to gun violence. A lot of those aggravated crimes or aggravated assaults are also associated to gun violence. And that is something we need to sort of take into consideration, particularly as so many different states are starting to consider gun control legislation. How do we improve the existing legislation in gun sales that allows individuals to purchase a firearm, particularly as so many incidents have taken place across the United States?
We're talking about the increasing homicide rates in many U.S. cities. Janice Owama is with us, assistant professor in the Department of Justice, Law, and Criminology at American University. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this increase in homicides last year and this year in particular? After years of declines, lower levels compared to, say, the 90s, how worried are you about your own safety in your community? And what do you want to see change, if anything? More police, different kinds of policing, community efforts, education, gun regulations. What do you want? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about a rise in homicide rates in cities across the country. A recent ABC News story highlighted 12 major U.S. cities that have broken annual homicide records. At a 13th, Milwaukee, sitting at 193, six more than last year's record high. Janice Owama stays with us, assistant professor in the Department of Justice, Law, and Criminology at American University. You can join us at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your ideas on what might be causing this increase in violence, possible solutions to it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to Amy in Green Bay. Amy, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I had two comments about why we might not or why we're having lesser police and more increase in crime. Number one, this whole idea of defund the police has been demoralizing to police, and many of them have just said, we're done and out of here. And as far as the cities seeing big increases, I know in Chicago, we're just a state line over, and they required vaccinations, and many of them said no, and they left and took jobs in suburbs or towns where they weren't forced to be vaccinated. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Amy, thanks for the call. Janice, first of all, the defund the police slogan that came out of the protests you mentioned last year, is that part of the story here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with following the police protests associated to sort of the push towards defunding the police has led the morale behind police agencies pretty low. I think a lot of police agencies have unfortunately engaged in what we consider to be depolicing, where they've taken a step back from some of those responsibilities, whether consciously or unconsciously. I think to a certain extent, some of the surrounding issues associated to changes in policing, the removal of certain police chiefs, the departure of certain police chiefs that so many police officers follow, has left some police officers feeling like they're not certain how things are going to move forward. And of course, changes to some of the protocol associated to mandating vaccines has been a significant issue, particularly as the short turnaround has expected so many officers to sort of be vaccinated within a short time period. I do think that this is sort of the reason why police agencies not only need to focus on trying to engage with their citizens and their residents, they also need to have a conversation with their own officers and trying to develop what is a path for both increasing trust and legitimacy in their own communities, but also increasing trust within the agency, making sure that officers are aware of the changes before those changes take place. Having conversations with how it affects them and their families is something that we don't see happening, because as soon as one leader leaves, another leader comes in with an agenda with very little conversations, very little understanding about what that change is going to look like.
Thanks a lot for that call, Amy, at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Micah in Elgin, Illinois. Micah, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. One thing that I wanted to talk about is that this is not surprising at all, honestly. I'm a communications major, and a lot of what I have studied this past semester has been social unrest and all of the structures that go into crime and stuff like that. And honestly, this is kind of the tipping point. This is something that has built up for a long, long time, you know, with the pandemic, with people losing their jobs, with just a whole lot with all the police issues. People are tired. People are scared. People are angry. And unless these systemic issues are resolved, then we're not going to see a lot of peace.
Micah, thanks a lot for that call. Janice, Micah sees systemic issues here that aren't going to be solved quickly.
Yeah, absolutely, Micah. You're right about that. I think there is a need for change, but that change should not be going back to what we used to do or what has been done in the past. I think when we talk about change, and I walk into so many of these community meetings that happen to engage with police agencies, people are not looking to go back to previous practices or looking to go back to things that they've done in the past, but they're looking for innovative ways. They're looking for a new path, a new change, rather than simply trying to go back. I mean, a lot of the issues we see with policing, we saw in the 1960s and 70s. This isn't old news. This isn't new news. Rather, this is old news. This is something we've seen before. When we talk about, you know, discriminatory policing, when we talk about racial profiling, these are issues that have taken place in the United States for a very long time. But we've oftentimes done very little and hope that with a certain change or a certain policy in place, we might be able to get rid of it. But the truth of the matter is, these are conversations that need to happen every day, they need to happen every month, and they need to continue happening. As soon as an issue goes away, we shouldn't stop having these conversations. What we need to do is really think outside of the box, and police agencies need to be part of that conversation. Policymakers need to be part of that conversation as much as community leaders.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about an increase in homicides, especially in U.S. cities, with Janice Owama from American University. Back to your calls now. Matt is with us in Bemidji, Minnesota. Matt, hi. Are you there, Matt?
Hello.
Yep, go for it, Matt.
Yes. Hi. So the question I have is about what the data is generally showing when it comes to the spatial and neighborhood areas where the increase in homicide is occurring. And then I'm also curious about the actual context of these homicides. And the reason I'm asking these questions is based on what I've seen in the data over past years in my line of work, a lot of homicides, it's usually about half, tend to be lovers' quarrels, and then a good number of them as well are between friends and people. You know, they get angry with each other, and so I'm just wondering if, like, contextually, just people are under more stress, et cetera, that's leading to this.
Interesting, Matt. Thanks for the call. A couple of big questions there, Janice. First of all, how localized this violence is. I've talked to researchers in the past who say a lot of times you could really focus in on a few, you know, city blocks even to find a lot of the violent crime. Do we know yet, again, given that we still don't have all the data for this year, of course, do we know how localized this violence is?
No, absolutely. So far, from what we know from some of the major cities that are already providing that data on their own websites, we've found that, as you've noted before, violent crimes is very focused on just certain city blocks. It's affecting a very small number of communities and a very small number of people, even with gun violence more broadly, not only murders, but talking about gun violence in general. People that are being affected by that every day of their lives are living in those particular areas, and it's really not evenly distributed across the city. We found from a recent survey, very much an illustration of that. There's so many people that discuss defunding the police. People in those particular areas that really are experiencing and traumatized by that gun violence are not asking. They want police to be involved in it. They want police to help deal with their everyday situation, which is gun violence. It is a real problem. It is a real problem for a small number of people, small number of communities, and it is definitely something that needs to be addressed.
And Matt also brought up the issue of domestic violence, homicide. Do we know how big a part of the story of record homicides that is?
Unfortunately, with domestic violence, we know of those cases that are being reported. Domestic violence in general is an extremely underreported crime. Even more so during the pandemic, we found that of those surveys that have been done of a number of households, that in domestic violence incidents, very few were reported. We saw a slight drop even though we know for a fact that that is not the case, because so many people just did not want to make those calls during the pandemic due to concerns, again, of social distancing. But with so many people at home, the assumption is, due to the level of unrest, that there was an increase in domestic violence. And unfortunately, those were the cases, both for the victims themselves and police agencies, that became so difficult to respond to, particularly during the height of the pandemic.
Thanks for that call. Just in our last minute and a half, Janice, so many of the things you're talking about don't sound like they have quick fixes. That said, if a mayor of a big city facing this problem called you up and said, is there something we can do to try to turn things around for 2022, what suggestions would you have for them?
Absolutely. There are not any quick fixes. By no means do I want to sell that point. But there are ways to begin having these conversations. There are so many cities that are starting to engage in some innovative practices. For example, when we talk about some of those everyday incidents like traffic stops and the concerns with discriminatory policing, racial profiling in traffic stops, there have been a lot of cities that, for example, have gotten rid of making the primary reason for stopping an equipment violation in order to increase the trust and legitimacy with their citizens, in order to reduce the number of altercations that could potentially take place. There's a lot of communities that have also started developing more opportunities for engaging in conversations, trying to get citizens to report any citizen complaints, not in person, but via an app. I think some of these innovative practices that are already taking place in some of the major cities like New York City, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., are something that cities have to start taking a look at and seeing, you know, are these effective? If they were able to implement them in their own city, would it help some of those issues that are currently in place? Would it help address some of the concerns that their citizens have? I think we need to start looking at what other places are doing to try to incorporate that rather than starting from scratch. I also think people need to start thinking and getting into conversations, not necessarily in person, but virtually, because there is an opportunity, there is a platform, and there are a lot of people that want to be supported. There are a lot of people that want their concerns addressed. And so I think with so many new police leaders coming into place, this is a great opportunity to change the way things are.
That's where we'll leave it. Thanks to our guest, Janice Owama, assistant professor at American University's Department of Justice, Law and Criminology, joining us for a look at rising homicide rates. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it can be easy to lose faith in the fight against climate change. But environmentalist Jane Goodall has spent decades in the movement. She says staying hopeful isn't just a slogan, it's a necessity. Jane Goodall joins the show today at 6 on 1A+. Now, how does a fictional character come to life? And can we really understand the characters we meet in real life? Those are just a couple themes that arise in a new collection of essays by author Anne Patchett. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the creative process? Are you a writer yourself? What inspires your characters, your stories? What makes them come alive? And as a reader, what makes a fictional character come alive for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Anne Patchett is co-owner of Parnassus Books in Nashville. She's author of a bunch of novels and nonfiction books. Her most recent novel is The Dutch House. Her latest work is a collection of essays called These Precious Days. Anne, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Something that struck me right off the bat, and I never thought about this. You, and you say other fiction writers, you have these characters and their stories in your head, and you worry what happens to them if something happens to me. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, you know, you think about it and you're walking around with a world that you've created. You're the only person who knows these people when it's fiction. I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and we started talking about Toni Morrison and Beloved. And you think, well, what if something had happened to Toni Morrison while she was writing Beloved, and we never got to know Setha and Denver and Paul D and Beloved and all of these characters that are so iconic? And I think that really explains what it would be like if a fiction writer was to die in the middle of a novel.
You got this responsibility to these characters that you feel, but later on in the book, you're also talking about, you know, the early stages where, you know, you might know your character is a woman who's going to go to India, but you don't know why yet or what's driving her there. When is it for you that there's this puzzle you're trying to figure out in someone, and when they start to take on that life of their own, that you feel this responsibility toward?
I don't actually ever really think they take on a life of their own. I always think it's pretty much my life.
Sure.
But the farther I get into it, sometimes it's a year, sometimes it's a couple of months, but you start to know that you're the only person who can tell this story. Unlike nonfiction, where it's something that's actually happened that you're recording and probably somebody else could finish the story for you.
Now, here we are during the pandemic, and you decided, hey, let's work on some essays right now. What led you to do that?
Well, I didn't want to start something that was really long because, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, none of us knew what was going to happen. Actually, a lot of us don't know what's going to happen still. And so things that were shorter seemed better, and also things that were true. Sometimes when the world is so strange, it's like it takes all of your imagination just to keep up with the reality of what's around you. So better to write about the reality than to make up more things.
Another thing that struck me is you really dive into people in the real world. Just two quick examples. You had this at one point in your life, a plane ticket to Vienna that you had to use within a year. And you're on a fourth date with this guy and you say, you want to go to Vienna? And you're married to that guy now. And then a friend, a professional acquaintance who grew to be a friend, you ended up inviting her into your home while she was getting a pancreatic cancer treatment. We're going to talk more about Suki in a bit. But I don't know. I can't imagine diving in and just like going in whole hog with a person like that without knowing them all that well.
Yeah, I actually really like people. And I'm very...
Some of my best friends are my problem, right?
Yeah. I find people really, really interesting. If I'm sitting next to somebody and they start to talk, I always think, okay, there's a reason I should listen. There's always something to learn. And it also doesn't mean that I let every person into my home, but every now and then I do. It's a good risk.
Talking to Anne Patchett, author of a number of books. Her latest novel is The Dutch House. We're talking about her new collection of essays. It's called These Precious Days. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for Anne Patchett, a favorite novel or character of hers, that's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or, of course, tweet us at Central Time WPR. You also talk a lot about memory in the book. And one essay I loved was somebody called you up and said, hey, we found this award you received and you were a teenager. And that set you on this whole, I don't know, effort to track down your writings and try to decide, is it worth keeping the letters you've written and awards you've received and things like that? What kind of things did you go through?
That was the weirdest story. Caller ID is the great joy of my life, as it's true for so many of us. But the phone started ringing, and it was my birthday. So the phone rings all the time on my birthday, and it was dark, and I ran across the room, and I grabbed the phone without looking. And it was this young man who said that he had found an award I had won when I was in high school. And it was in the back of his mother's nightstand. And I finally pieced together that what had happened, I used to cram things into my bedside table when I was a kid. The papers had fallen behind the drawers. The bedside table went with my grandmother into assisted living, then a dementia unit. After she died, we didn't take the bedside table. And it went off, you know, on its own journey into the world. All these years later, his mother buys it at an auction. And by all these years later, I mean, my grandmother's been dead for 17 years. And then he finds the papers stuck behind the drawers and he wants to bring them back to me. He says, this is really, really important. There were just some like poems I had written in high school, stuff you don't ever want to see again. But he said, no, you know, you won this prize. This changed your life. This set you on your way. He absolutely insisted on driving 2 hours to bring them to me in the bookstore. And it did set me off on this whole journey of whether or not I wanted to deal with all the paperwork in my past, which was kind of overwhelming. And I really only half dealt with it. Every time I would open up the box, I would sort of scream and slam down the lid again.
I think a lot of us have been in this situation. I've gone through the, you know, the trunk of old letters from my folks' place. The difference is Library of Congress is never going to call Rob Ferret and say, hey, we want your papers, man. They did for Ann Patchett, though, I understand. How do you answer something like that? How do you say, yeah, here's my life in the form of paper?
Yeah, right. I just kept putting them off because I have to deal with it, right? Like, you can't just mail the Library of Congress all those boxes without reading this stuff. You've got to take a look at it and organize it in some way and figure it out. And while I've done a little bit of that work, I have, shall we say, not gotten to the bottom of the box yet.
So is the Library of Congress ever going to get anything from you?
Yeah. Eventually they will. It's a very interesting conversation that people in my business have, because you can sell your papers to private universities, to schools, to libraries, or you can donate them to the Library of Congress. So, you know, one has more prestige and the other has more money. But I figure if I'm dead, I won't need the money. So it's fine.
Now, one thing I would never really think to ask a guest on the show, or really anybody in my life, is along the lines of, why don't you have kids? Or when are you going to have kids? You write, people ask you this a lot, sometimes even in the midst of public radio interviews. What's going on with that?
Yeah, you can't even believe it. And what's so funny about that, it's an essay called There Are No Children Here. As long as I have been a professional writer, people have been asking me to write a nonfiction piece about not having children. And I always thought, oh, that's not very interesting. I mean, I don't. Who cares? So what? But people ask all the time. And it was really fun to sort of just compile all of the crazy things people have said to me over the years about why it was so important that I have children. And now that the essay has been published and other people are reading it, I heard from a woman who has 6 children. And she said, everywhere I go, people come up to me and say, I can't believe you had 6 children. That's so selfish. You should have thought about the environment. You should have thought about the planet. That's too many children. And then I have a friend who has 1 child, and people come up to her and say, that's so terrible that you only had 1 child. That child's going to be all alone. You need to have at least 2 children. And what that really is all about is choice. And when we start having a conversation about choice, people think that we're talking about abortion. But actually, choice is just choice. It's reproductive freedom, which means I choose to not have kids. And my friend Aaron chooses to have 1, and Alice chooses to have 6, and someone else might choose to have an abortion, but it's all choice.
You in that same essay, you talk about you were on stage with a famous author, capitalized. You don't name the names. You can drop the name here if you want. It's up to you. Your choice. but he said something to the effect of, "You can't be a great author if you don't have kids." I feel like you've done okay, though, Anne.
That's really kind of you. Thank you so much. Yeah, he said, you'll never know love. You'll never know what it means to know love if you don't have children. And I was about 30 at the time. And he had already told me that I had to have an office outside the home. And we were on a stage. And that I had to have a visual dictionary. And then the third thing I had to have was children. And, you know, what am I going to do? Smack my forehead and go, okay, I'm going to run, go get some of those so that I can be a real writer. People just, it's really nutty, the opinions that other people can have about our lives. So I kind of mean it as a larger conversation, not just about children.
We're talking to author Ann Patchett about her new book. It's a collection of essays called These Precious Days. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Has reading offered you consolation, encouragement, escape during the pandemic? Has writing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk now with author Ann Patchett. She's co-owner of Parnassus Books in Nashville. We're talking about her latest work. It's a collection of essays called These Precious Days. And Ann, I want to get into that title essay about your growing friendship with someone who you met as a professional acquaintance, really, your friend Sookie. Can you talk us through the opening of your story and how you got to know Sookie?
Sure. So people send me books all the time. They want me to blurb them. And I had a copy of Tom Hanks's book that hadn't been published. It was a collection of short stories called Uncommon Type. It was a great book. I gave it a blurb. And then later I was asked to go to Washington, D.C. to interview Tom on stage. While I was there, very briefly, I met his assistant, a woman named Sookie Raphael, who I just thought was a fascinating person. We struck up a little email friendship because Tom was interested in possibly opening a bookstore. And then he agreed to do the audiobook for the Dutch House. And he came to Nashville every now and then. So I kind of kept seeing him, but Sookie was always in touch to make his arrangements. And we emailed about painting. She was a painter, just a really interesting person. And over the course of a couple of years, I found out that she had had pancreatic cancer. She had had a surgery, chemo and radiation, was pronounced cancer-free. The cancer came back. She was trying to find a clinical trial to get into very, very fast. And my husband is a doctor, and he said, have her send me her files. I'll see if I can get her into a trial here. He did. She came here. She was just coming for 10 days, and then she was going to go back to LA because UCLA was going to start the same clinical trial. But in that 10 days, the pandemic hit, and UCLA canceled the trial, and flights were canceled. And it was like she really got shipwrecked here. She could not go home. I mean, if she had gone home, it would have been the end of her, because the only thing keeping her alive was that clinical trial. So suddenly my husband was practicing telemedicine in the dining room. My book tour was canceled. I was home, and Sookie was downstairs painting, because for the first time in her life, she had time. And the three of us formed this fantastic lockdown friendship. And it was an extraordinary gift for all of us.
If you had written this as a novel, I think it would just feel weirdly contrived and awkward, but this is your real life. And you write about, you know, it's one thing to know a fictional character, to create a fictional character. You talk in the book about Sookie, you can't really define her. You're getting to know her slowly and slowly over this very intense period of time. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, I remember when I went to college when I was 17, and you walk into this tiny room with two twin beds and there's another person there. And it's like, oh, hey, stranger, we're going to live together in this room for a year. And it's terrifying. And then if you're lucky, you find out that you really care for this person. So it was a little bit like that. It was a big risk. But on the other hand, who wouldn't do it? You know, if you knew somebody and you think it might prolong their life to be part of this clinical trial, I can get them out, I can help them. And then you get stuck. Well, that is what it is. But it's a fantastic way to get to know somebody, because I mean, we had three meals a day together. We worked out together every day. We walked the dog. I mean, every single thing we did together, because we were locked down and we had so much time. And of course, Sookie didn't have so much time because she had recurrent pancreatic cancer. And so the time became so precious, and we didn't talk about the past and we didn't talk about the future. We just really lived inside of each day, which was a real pandemic thing to do. And also, I used to always say recurrent pancreatic cancer trumps COVID. So we worried very little about the pandemic, except that we didn't want Sookie to get sick.
Talking to Ann Patchett about her new book of essays. It's called These Precious Days. And going back to your introduction, you concluded talking about the fact that we're mortal, through Sookie's story, we see that with COVID going on around you. What kind of things did it make you think about the preciousness of time?
Yeah, I mean, not only was there a pandemic and pancreatic cancer, it was the weirdest spring ever. Now, of course, we've just done this again in Tennessee and Kentucky. But while she was here, there were a series of tornadoes. Over 20 people were killed. We had these bizarre straight line winds. It was the strangest spring for weather. And we just kept talking about all the different ways we could die. And it was also a really long, cold, wet, beautiful, beautiful spring. And when you start thinking, wow, you know, of course we're all going to die. I mean, that's sort of the deal. Nobody gets out of here alive. You don't know when you're going to die. Sookie had a better idea than the rest of us. But it does make you just open your eyes to the smallest things. You know, you think about a bucket list and the glorious, glamorous places you want to see before you die. But sometimes the real beauty is just inside your house. I thought so much about Dorothy Gale and The Wizard of Oz, and everything you need is probably in your own backyard.
So you went essays instead of a new novel at the beginning of the pandemic. You didn't want to have that long-term thing in your head now. Have you come back to that now? Are you revisiting? Are you working maybe on that next novel?
Well, right now I'm doing publicity for this book,
and very
I'm going to do it for 2 more days. People keep saying to me, "What are you writing?" And I say, "I'm writing my name," because I co-own this bookstore, and we're getting orders from all over the country of people wanting personalized copies. So what I'm writing for 4 to 6 hours every day are notes on people's books that we then mail out. But I'm figuring after the first of the year that will all calm down. And then, yeah, I'm really looking forward to writing fiction again. There's great freedom in making everything up.
You mentioned the bookstore, and I understand there's some celebration here. You just marked a 10-year anniversary of Parnassus.
Yes, we were so excited. And of course, we thought that that was the other thing. We thought that the pandemic would kill the bookstore. It's a little local independent bookstore, and our customers were just fantastic. We closed in March, and we were closed until October, and people just kept ordering their books from us and keeping us going, and it was a huge, huge gift.
Last time we talked to you, Anne, we got lots of great reading recommendations for you. Now, I know most of your time is spent, it sounds like, signing your name on your own book. When you have time, or if you've had time lately, what has inspired you? What have you enjoyed reading lately?
Oh, it's my favorite question. Okay, so if you have any kids in the house, Kate D. Camillo has a new book out called The Beatrice Prophecies. That's a middle grade novel. So it's basically for anybody for 8 years old on up. It worked fine for me, and I'm 58. It's one of those books that people will be reading for generations and generations to come. So if you've got any kids in your house, be sure to get them a copy of The Beatrice Prophecies. Louise Erdrich, who's one of my all-time favorite writers, has a magnificent new book out called The Sentence, about the haunting of an independent bookstore. Louise also owns an independent bookstore, Birchbark Books, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Greg Boyle's new book, which is called The Whole Language, The Power of Extravagant Tenderness. Greg Boyle is the founder of Homeboy Industries in Los Angeles, which is the world's largest gang prevention and rehabilitation program. This is Father Greg's third book, and it's just all about how to be a more decent human being.
I love it. And thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob. I had a great time.
Anne Patch is an author, co-owner of Parnassus Books in Nashville. We talked to her today about her most recent work, a book of essays. It's called These Precious Days.